What's so different about my God? Once upon a time, many, many years ago, there was a God in heaven who looked down upon the world and saw all the evils that were taking place. In this world was a particularly cruel and evil king, an oppressive tyrant. No mercy in him. His concern was for himself only. The God, upon seeing this, was grieved. All these evils happening in the world. So, through a divine messenger, a woman was given a prophecy that she would bear a son that would deliver them from the power of the evil king. The evil king learned of the prophecy and took steps to make sure that it would remain unfulfilled. He killed the newborn males in an attempt to prevent the fulfillment of the prophecy. But soon enough, the woman conceived. A miraculous conception, it was said, one that came apart from normal human relations. It is said that this boy was the God himself come down to the world, to live among man, to teach the world how to live. When the time came and the deliverer was born, another divine messenger appeared to warn the couple to flee before the evil king learned of the boy's whereabouts. The boy grew up hidden from the evil king. And when he grew up into a man, it is said that he slew the king. While in this world, this boy that grew up to be a man taught his disciples three ways to come to God: through knowledge, through righteousness, and through devotion. And devotion, he said, was the most important of the three. And devotion meant love to a personal God and a complete surrender to him. This man was killed, but it is said that he was taken back up to heaven to resume his position as God. Sounds a little familiar, doesn't it? A little, some familiar elements. You might think, you know, it could be kind of like the birth and life of Jesus, possibly. But even in my abridged retelling, where my point was to emphasize the similarities, there are features of the story that just don't seem quite right. What I related just now is a Hindu legend. A legend that is said to have taken place about 3,000 years ago and recorded several centuries prior to the birth of Christ. It's the legend of the Lord Krishna, the eighth incarnation, it is said, of one of the gods of the Hindu Trinity called Vishnu, the preserver. The woman who gave birth to Krishna is known as Devaki, the evil king Kansa, the way of knowledge, yoga, the way of righteousness, dharma, the way of devotion, bhakti. The world today is much different than the world we had a century or even 50 years ago. Back then, at least in much of the Western world, most people believed that the Bible held at least some measure of authority. But as knowledge and information increased, people learned that the stories, the themes, the teachings, and the characters in the Bible aren't necessarily unique. In fact, many of the ideas in the Bible can be found in other religions and cultures. Outside, even outside of the three, what we consider the Abrahamic religions of Islam, Jew, and Christianity. And some of these other religions include, like Hinduism, but also Buddhism, Shintoism, and there are many others. In these and others, there are stories of gods that have come to live among humans, stories of a virgin birth, the grand theme of a cosmic conflict between good and evil, themes about personal salvation, themes about living a life pleasing to the gods. And so, today, to many people, the Bible and Christianity is simply one of many competing faith claims. It isn't necessarily better or worse than any others. For many people, it's simply another way. Thus, as Christians, when we take the Bible and present the facts and figures or the straight knowledge found inside the Bible, the response is typically, so what? How's that any different from, and they'll start naming whatever else, other religions that they might have tried or know about. 2,000 years ago in the Roman Empire, I believe similar questions were being asked. The Romans had their own gods and their own legends, the Greeks too, the Egyptians, the Persians, the Jews, they all had their stories. And then, amidst all of these conflicting and competing claims about Christianity, in just a couple of centuries, or and amidst all these conflicting and competing claims, there arose Christianity. And in just a couple of centuries, it had effectively swept away most other belief systems in that part of the world. So there was something different about Christianity. Even with similar stories and themes, there was still something different, something that caught the attention of the people at that time. Like the people of the first century hearing about Christianity for the first time, I believe it would be good for us to stop and think about why any of us should choose Christianity and the Christian God over another religion and its God or gods, or why your non-Christian family member, neighbor, or friend should give consideration to Christianity over something else. I'm going to ask Shelley to come up. And make sure it's the right one. Pass one out and take it and take a piece and taste it. What do you think? Honestly, what do you think? Pretty bland? Yeah, I think I do. Mm-hmm. Keep that in mind. Just keep that on the back of your head. 2,000 years ago, so into a sea of conflicting and confusing beliefs came the eternal, uncreated Word, who was with God and was God. This Word was the Creator and the Life Giver, and who through life became light, the true light that shines in the darkness. John wrote that we can become children of God, not just simply adopted children, but natural children of God through the process of rebirth. The only condition is that we accept and believe in Jesus. And today we conclude our look into our investigation of the prologue section. This is John chapter 1, verses 14 through 18. And I believe it's in these texts where the essence of what makes Christianity unique is found. It's why I choose to be a Christian. And it's why I believe the Bible is worth reading. Because without this one element, Christianity devolves into just another belief system. No different, really, than from any other religion. Verse 14 reads, "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." Starts with the phrase, "The Word became flesh." This word flesh can also be translated or understood as human. So God chose to become a human being. The word became indicates a transformation. Now we read in verse 12 where we become children of God. It's the same transformation that's being talked about here, a mysterious transformation. Humans becoming children of God is a mystery, and so is God becoming human. It's a mystery. I don't think we'll ever fully understand what it means. But even the greater mystery is that the Word didn't cease to be God. But is this what's unique about Christianity? I don't think so. The fact that a God appeared as a man isn't a unique theme. It's not a unique idea. There's another phrase in verse 14. This Word made His dwelling among us. He came to live amongst the very people that would reject and kill Him. He lived, He dwelt. This word dwelling, He made His dwelling, can also be read, He tabernacled, or He pitched a tent. To the Jewish readers of John anyway, it would have evoked images of the Old Testament wilderness tabernacle or the sanctuary, where God's glory was present and visible, at least to some of the priests, in the most holy compartment. The word glory, which is also in this verse 14, and the word tent, where the word dwelling comes from, have the same root in the Hebrew language. So in Hebrew thinking, glory and tent mean really the same thing. And in our study of verse 11 a few weeks back, we learned that the Word came home. Not only did He come home, but in verse 14 we learned that the Word made this world His home, a place to stay for a while with us. But is this idea unique to Christianity? And again, I have to say no. Another phrase in verse 14 reads, the one and only who came from the Father. The one and only in some translations is the only begotten. Here John is emphasizing the uniqueness of Jesus in the Christian worldview. When John uses this particular phrasing, whether it's the only begotten or the one and only, it always applies to Jesus in His gospel. What He's saying, what He's trying to emphasize here is that although humans can become children of God, like we learn in verses 12 and 13, we can never become as Jesus is. Jesus is unique. And so this is John's refutation of belief systems in which people believe they can become gods themselves, whether it's through acquiring superior knowledge, such as Gnosticism. Or maybe it's through reincarnation that some belief systems believe you can become gods. Or by living a good enough life, maybe a perfect life, you can enter into your God's graces in the afterlife. You know, but is this idea of having a God having a son and sending a son unique? And again, no, it's not unique. So we continue looking at verse 14, and there's another phrase here, full of grace and truth. And I believe this phrase starts to give the reason why God did what He did, to allow us the opportunity to become His children. The word grace in Greek is charis, where we get the word charisma. It also refers to the idea of spiritual gifts. In Hebrew, the same word is chesed, one of David's favorite words in the Psalms. In the Old Testament, this word chesed is usually translated loving kindness or unfailing love. So when you read the Old Testament and see loving kindness or the phrase unfailing love, think grace. That's what it means. Then there's this other word, truth. Now, we often think of truth as knowledge, but I believe it's more than that. Some translations use the word faithfulness instead. Verse 14 also contains the word glory. When we think of glory, we associate it with a bright light. And when we think of the light of the world, we think of truth. So glory, light, and truth, their three terms are all related. And what I believe John is trying to communicate here is that the Word was much more than the types and the symbols of the past. That the Word was much more than the prophets. That the Word declared all that was true about God. And what's true about God? And what John is trying to tell us. I think what John is trying to tell us is what is true about God is that He is gracious. and He is faithful. So what John is getting to is the reason for Jesus becoming man, for Jesus living among humans, for Jesus making His home in the world, for Jesus choosing to obey the will of His Father. And I believe that this is getting down to the essence of the uniqueness of Christianity and the uniqueness of the God that I choose to believe in. John says, writes also that we have seen His glory. John, the author, is a witness to the glory of Jesus. The glory of God in the Old Testament was in the sanctuary or the temple. It was limited in visibility. But now when we look at the entirety of verse 14, John is telling us that this glory that used to be limited to the sanctuary and the temple now is in Jesus and made visible even to ordinary people. John saw this at the Transfiguration when he, with Peter and James, was able to witness the full divinity of Jesus. And so together with the sanctuary and temple imagery, John is saying that Jesus is the embodiment of all that the Old Testament tried to show about God through rituals and symbols. Now, and God's glory, what is that? It's His grace and faithfulness for us and to us. As glorious as the sanctuary might have been, as glorious as the temple, Solomon's temple, may have been, John is saying Jesus' glory eclipses all of that. Because the Old Testament didn't reveal God's glory in its completeness. But now, through Jesus, God's glory is revealed completely and perfectly. Verse 15 now says, John testifies concerning Him, John the Baptist, that is. He cries out saying, "This was He of whom I said, He who comes after me has surpassed me because He was before me." Now John, the author of the Gospel, again inserts a few words here about John the Baptist. Now why is that? It may be partly to complete the chiastic structure of the prologue. We learned about that a couple weeks ago, where I gave a short outline of the prologue section, where things are paired up until we get the climax of verses 12 and 13. But again, John brings in John the Baptist to say that John the Baptist was simply a witness to the true light of the true Messiah. Now, in the very first sermon that I began on this series, I mentioned, or I noted, that there was a religious sect who followed John the Baptist as the Messiah. Here John is saying that John the Baptist himself said he wasn't the Messiah. Verse 16 now reads, "From the fullness of His grace we have all received one blessing after another." Or another translation reads, "From His abundance we have all received one gracious blessing after another." The word that John is talking about, Jesus, is full of grace. It echoes the phrasing in verse 14 where we read, we have the phrase, full of grace. We have all received this grace. From Gandhi to Hitler, from Mother Teresa to Saddam Hussein, we've all received the grace. In the chiastic structure, this verse 16 pairs up with verses 4 and 5, where verses 4 and 5 talk about the gift of life and light, or what we can now say, truth. So I think what John is trying to point out is that life, light, truth, and grace, they can't be separated. They come together. They're all gifts. Now, grace upon grace, or one gracious blessing after another, depending on the translation that you have. It speaks of the fullness or the abundance of God's grace. Just when we think we've exhausted God's grace, we find that there's even more. Verse 17 reads, "For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." In this verse, John is implying the recreation. The chiastic pair is verse 3, where John tells us that the Word is the Creator. And so in relation to that verse, here John is implying a recreation of us. And grace, he says, is the power behind that recreation. And why in the world does John bring up Moses? As we'll see through much of John's gospel, Jewish leaders frequently pointed to Moses as their greatest prophet and the giver of the law, and the revealer of Yahweh, the true God. We can also see the author of Hebrews in chapter 3 arguing that Jesus is greater than Moses, because the Jews believed Moses to be the greatest. And John is also saying that however good the law or the Torah was, even in the places where God spoke directly to Moses, it was still an incomplete revelation of God. Why? Because the law, the Torah, was couched and given in terms that the Israelites could understand at the time of their Exodus. The later prophets would try to expand the revelation of God, but the people were stubborn, and they refused to listen. So the revelation of God in the Old Testament became limited by human stubbornness. And as time progressed, the law had become corrupted and misrepresented. And even when the law was considered a good thing, it could never save humans. And so John is telling us here that Jesus is greater than Moses. Jesus is the one and only perfect revelation of God. And it is only through Jesus and through His grace that salvation is available. Grace is better than law because grace conquers the condemnation brought about by the law. We read, just a couple chapters later in John 3, verses 16 and 17, one of the most famous verses, I'm sure, "For God so loved the world that He gave His one and only Son, that whoever believes in Him should not perish, but have eternal life. For God did not send His Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through Him." And that's why I believe grace is the central tenet of Christianity. It's the one thing that differentiates Christianity from all other religions. It's the heart of the gospel. It's the reason I choose to believe the Christian God. It's the reason I believe my God is faithful. It's the reason I believe my God is trustworthy. And it's the one thing that I believe continues to attract people to my God. Way back during the Exodus in Leviticus 2, verse 13, God spoke to Moses saying, "Season all your grain offerings to remind you of God's eternal covenant. Never forget to add salt to your grain offerings." What's the eternal covenant? Well, we have the rainbow after the flood. There's the Abrahamic covenant. There were a number of other God-initiated covenants for the Hebrews. There's the new covenant. In all cases, a covenant from God is God's promise that He will do something good for us. In every case, the theme is that God's grace delivers and saves. And so when God initiated the system of sacrifices, He instructed that salt must be used in grain offerings, whether cooked or not, as a reminder of God's grace, and looking forward to the time when grace would be fully revealed in Jesus Christ. In Matthew 5, one of Jesus' first sermons, He spoke about salt and light. In verse 13, He says, "You are the salt of the earth. And he continues on, but he doesn't really say, Jesus doesn't really say anything about doing much with salt other than making sure that it stays salty. Verse 14 then, he talks about the light. You are the light of the world. But here Jesus tells and instructs more about the light. He says the light needs to shine. Jesus says that the light shouldn't be hidden, and that the light is about good deeds. What I find interesting is that salt is mentioned before the light. And at least to me, the order is intentional and significant. Grace comes first. Righteousness comes afterwards. We're first to be bearers of grace to the world. Once a person accepts God's grace, then righteousness begins to make sense. And I wonder, how often do we hear Christians, or maybe even ourselves, exhorting righteous living, but forgetting that grace comes first? So I believe that we're called first to be grace givers to the world, before we're called to be teachers of righteousness. Verse 18 reads, "No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known." Others in the past may have, quote, seen God, but it was only in limited ways. We can think of Moses, Abraham who saw God, Jacob, Gideon. But now, John is saying, Jesus has come into the world and made him known to us. This phrase, made him known, means Jesus is God's explainer, the perfect revelation. Or the theological term is exegesis. Jesus is the exegeter of the Father, the explainer. And Jesus being God and with the Father always is the one and only, this phrase again, the one and only being and the person qualified to reveal perfectly and completely God's character. And John uses a phrase, at the Father's side or at his side, which is the same phrasing and words that he uses when he talks about himself in John 13, verse 23, at the Last Supper, where he is reclining next to Jesus. It's a picture, an image of intimacy, of reclining upon one another's bosom during a meal. And it's a deliberate use by John. A subtle message that John, being the disciple that entered most closely into Jesus' affections, and the only one of the 12 disciples present at the cross, because of that, John offers the greatest revelation of Jesus, just as Jesus offers the greatest revelation of the Father. The first part of John's prologue from verses 1 to 18, the first part of the prologue traces Jesus' journey to enter our world. It's about transcendence, or the God that is greater than humans. The second part, from 14 to 18, traces how we are able to be reconciled with the Father. It's about immanence, about the God that chose to identify with us as humans, to identify with us. It's about grace that allows us to join God's family. And so no wonder the Apostle Paul talked so much about grace. Amidst all the competing claims of faith in the ancient world, all the other religions pictured gods as finicky, human-like beings to be feared and appeased, or that people have to do enough good or gain enough knowledge to have a good afterlife. But in these religions, there's no assurance. There's really only fear and doubt that a person might have missed something and thus end up in some form of hell. Or, if not hell, then they'll have to be reborn to live life all over again. Grace was the one element that distinguished Christianity from all other religions. Grace was the one thing that elevated Christianity above all other belief systems. Grace was the one element that brought assurance and cast out fear. Grace is the good news. Grace is the one thing that I hold tightly to. Grace is the one and only thing that made a real and lasting difference in my life. Grace is what allowed the Bible and Christianity to make sense to me. Grace is the salt that was missing in most of my earlier years of following religious forms. Grace is the theme and purpose of the Bible. And that's why, like the Apostle Paul, I'm compelled to preach and teach grace, because everything else flows out from it. Everything else is subordinate to it. And I need to keep my life salty. And to do that, I need daily encounters with grace. In my book of short quotes on grace, here's one. The world is perishing for want of the gospel. The Lord desires that His word of grace shall be brought home to every soul. And another one. Grace is the center position in our faith, the core to which both the extremes of legalism and lawlessness need to return. Grace is the heart of the church doctrine that came out of the Reformation, the center of Adventist theology. And can I have Shelley come and pass out this one? Now, what Shelley is passing out is basically what we have for communion. It's communion bread. Now, is it any better? Go ahead. Go ahead and try it. Now, does salt make a difference? But to a person who is starving and hungry, it probably wouldn't matter which one. But once you know the difference, it makes a difference. A person may be satisfied on the unsalted one, if that's all they know. But once a person gets a little taste, that's better. Why would they ever want to go back to what they had before? For me, I don't know about you, but for me, if my life is missing the salt of grace, my Christianity, in essence, is no different than Hinduism. And the Lord Jesus, for me, then, offers me nothing more than Lord Krishna. And so that I may have peace and assurance, and be of genuine service to others, and to be a grace giver, I pray that what the Apostle Paul wrote to the believers in Colossae is true for me. In Colossians 4:6, Paul writes, "Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone."